Hi.
Hi. So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 115, John Proctor is the Villain by Kimberly Bellflower.
Hi, my name is Sadie Sink, and I'm returning to Broadway in Kimberly Bellflower's play, John Proctor is the Villain. John Proctor is the Villain is energetic, witty, and daring. I first read the play a little bit over a year ago. I really fell in love with it. Kimberly is an incredible playwright, and she has a way of painting young people and young people's voices in a super authentic way. Just seeing an ensemble cast made up of young actors and actresses, like, it's just super, super powerful, and something in a straight play too. That's something that is super rare, talking about themes that are so relevant now, and also tying it into a piece of classic American literature and causing you to kind of question some of the things that you were taught when you were first introduced to The Crucible. I really miss being on the stage, although it also terrifies me. But I think that's why I want to do it, especially after kind of just working on bigger productions for so long. I think it's nice to be ending a chapter in my life and then going back to where it all started. I love the community of theater. It's definitely nerve-wracking, but I think it's like the most excited I've been about something in a really long time.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we will take a thorough look at one piece of literature that we have both read and determine whether it is required reading. So here I am, ready to dance it out to Lord, and I'm joined by someone who does not like Lord. It's Tom Panarese.
Did I ever say I didn't like Lord?
Yeah, you found her boring.
Yeah, I do. I find her finding her boring. I don't like hate her or anything. I just kind of like,
yeah.
I mean, maybe it was because I know Royals is an old song at this point, but that song got so overplayed.
Yeah.
That I was just kind of like,
what about Green Light?
That was good.
Okay.
That was good. And yeah, yeah. I'm not, you know, I'm just kind of indifferent because I was just kind of like, just a little boring, but yes. But sure. Yes. No, I'm, yeah, you can dance to whatever you want to.
Lovely.
I am not the English teacher in this play, by the way.
No, that is why I decided not to go that route.
Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. Yes. Well, I think it was actually when I saw the show, that might have been the first time that I had heard Green Light by Lord in its entirety. So, and of course, now it's on a playlist of mine from that particular summer, I think. Yeah, that I went to go see it. So there you go. And it'll probably pop up on this episode. We're at it. Yeah.
But
yes, we are here to talk about John Proctor is the Villain. And you might be thinking to yourself, oh my gosh, have I misread The Crucible all these years? I guess we'll find out. That's certainly something that we can address as well, though I don't want to make the show about John Proctor because I do want to center the females.
I can answer their question for you right away.
Oh, wow.
No, you weren't misreading it because you weren't paying attention in English class when you were assigned to read it.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, I guess what is that, a 10th grade reading? I think I read it as a junior.
It's usually 11th grade, at least in Virginia, because 11th grade English in Virginia does tend to be American literature focused. So the 2 years I taught 11th grade back in the mid to late 2000s, I did The Crucible.
Gotcha. Yep. I mean, I always just remember this quote about, I know how you sweated like a stallion when you clutch my back behind the or something like that. I'm like, oh my gosh. And so one of my friends got a nickname as Stallion because he was reading as John Proctor at the time. But it does make you, as you read this, I think it does, I'm not saying that this is a correct or incorrect interpretation, but it does, I think, open your mind to a different interpretation because we are told certain things by English teachers as if there's, you know, some sort of conspiracy that goes on. And as I do, as I begin literature, in particular poetry in Latin, I always tell the students that I will never tell them something that I don't believe in. And, you know, I know that they've been inundated with like, this is a symbol and this is, you know, and all of that stuff. Yeah. And like, you can't really know 100% unless the author were right in front of you. So I just tried to, you know, let them know, like, I believe that this is this. Some other people believe that this is an interpretation for something else. So yeah, it's always fun to have these conversations as long as you're willing to deep dive into that.
Yeah. I think for me, the fact that you're thinking critically and analyzing it and discussing what the possibilities are is more important than whether or not you're getting the right or wrong answer on what the symbol is for. Now, there are certain symbols in literature that are so obvious you can't get the answer wrong. For instance, the green light in The Great Gatsby. Like, come on. But no, you're right. There's sometimes where it's interpreted. In fact, the meme that I hate the most as an English teacher, and I'm not alone in this as an English teacher and a book lover, is that stupid the curtains are blue one that went around a lot while ago. Your people are just kind of like bashing the idea of interpretation. It's like, maybe the author just wants the curtains to be blue, and it's like, that's not the point of what we're analyzing. And I get sometimes people overanalyze things to death, but I love getting into the meat of a story like that, especially an older one, 19th century, 18th century, or Shakespeare or something, because you are looking for those things, because you're looking for meaning in an old text that could apply to now. So
Yeah, today it was funny because what I love about teaching is that as long as you have humility as a teacher, sometimes students can either ask a question or say something that like boggles the mind that once you stop and think about it, like, wow, I've never thought of that before. So we were translating, my Latin 2 students have a translation that's going to be their test. And I gave it to them in advance, and they were translated. I've given them grammar questions, and so I've also been asking them discussion questions. And so there was a short sentence talking about, it's all about these sad things. One woman is a single parent, and so it's been very difficult. The other woman has been unable to get pregnant, so that's been very difficult. And so the one woman says, the other one, you're lucky because you have, you know, this very kind husband. And so the two words are Felix S. So you are lucky. And then one of my students said, could it be lucky? Because the S, which is you are, actually is also a form of the imperative, just the nature of that word. And I said, oh, wow, that's really interesting, because I wouldn't have thought about that. And then I asked, well, how does that interpretation change? If someone's saying be happy as a command, you know, what is that saying? What is the implication? Yeah. So having that discussion, then I said, I think in terms of the relationship between the women, probably it's just you are happy rather than her commanding her. But just little things like that, I think is really great to have those kind of conversations. And I feel like there are a couple moments this year with the Aeneid that going through it with these students, just them delving in deeper and pulling out things that I hadn't seen before, which has been just really lovely. So, but enough about that. What is your history with John Proctor's The Villain?
I didn't know the play existed until you talked about going to see it. And we may have talked about it, like you were telling me about the trip you took to see it, or you may have mentioned it on a BTO, or both. Mm. But yeah, I didn't. I'm not plugged into theater.
I see.
So I don't. You know, I don't. I do like a good play, and I do like going to see a good play. I just don't really pay much attention to theater, and I really don't like musical theater. So you had mentioned the play at some point, and then when you brought it up, this is my first time with any exposure to it, really, as far as reading it or anything like that. So kind of regretting not looking up clips on YouTube or something before we started recording the episode to see if there was anything I could kind of put a visual to. Mm-hmm. But yes, this is my first time reading it.
Yeah, lovely. And I think it was last summer that I went to see this with my friend Claire. And it sounded, I didn't know too much about it, to be honest, but just the title alone I thought was intriguing. Sadie Sink was the lead. She plays Shelby. And so that was enticing as well. She's my favorite character in Stranger
Stranger
Things.
Things.
Yep. And then once I started to actually I don't think I delved in too much, just like, oh, it takes place in a class, which I'm actually happy about because everything was very shocking when it was happening on stage at the time. And as the stage direction notes, if I think she says if you're at an hour 43, you are talking too slow. And so it really is rapid fire and it is nonstop. No intermission, which I really appreciate because that energy is just up, up, up. And then when I would almost call it, well, I guess it's not technically a climax, but like the big wham moment, once that happens and it's like a car screeching to a halt, like you really feel that pause within that. And then, yeah, and I got it. Oftentimes when I see a play that I really like, I immediately go to the Drama Bookstore in New York City and get it. So I got that. And there's a rumor that I remember they were tossing around whether this would become a film with the original cast. So I think that would be awesome to put that on the screen, but we shall see. So this is the first time that I've read it, and then second time that I have experienced. Oh yeah, 2025. It was announced that Belfour's play would be adapted into a film. And I do hope, yeah, that they keep the same cast.
I can the comment you made about if you're at like an hour 43, you've been talking too slowly. That tracks because you and I are around teenagers all day, and teenage girls talk fast. And I
Yeah.
mean, so it's if I can now if I go back and read it and I can kind of picture the cadence and the diction and the rhythm of
Yeah.
teen speak. That gives me a little bit more to it, and then like, okay, because there were sometimes there were lines like, do you really need this line in here? But if it's going at such a fast pace, like, okay, I can totally see how this goes in terms of like when it's being performed on stage. So yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and even if you look at the formatting of the lines, it almost feels like a poem. Just, I feel like capitalization is not really the name of the game there.
I don't think there's any, except for names, I don't think there are
Yeah,
any
so it just
capitals.
kind of goes in. Yeah, and there are definitely moments like Beth is kind of feels like she rambles a lot. And then the counselor, you can tell with how she speaks, because she'll start a thought and then stop and start a new thought, which I feel like gives a sense of how green she is and maybe like nervous in this new role. So yeah, a lot of that does a good job. But I guess we'll be talking about all of that. So first about Kimberly Bellflower. She was born, oh, look at this, June 22nd, 1987. She's best known, of course, for writing this Broadway play, John Proctor is the Villain, for which she was nominated for the Tony Award for Best Play at the 2025 Tony Awards. As I said, it's going to be adapted into a film. Who knows when that'll happen? She's from a small town in Appalachian, Georgia, which she does make a director's note in the play about, don't force the accent. It has to be very particular, which I appreciate. And so it's coming from someone who would know. She earned an MFA from the University of Texas in Austin in 2017. She teaches playwriting at Emory University. Her play Lost Girl premiered at the Milwaukee Rep in 2018 and went on to win the Kennedy Center, I don't think it's called that anymore, Darrell Ayers National Playwriting Award. And she began writing John Proctor's The Villain shortly after graduating from University of Texas in Austin in 2017. She was inspired by Stacey Schiff's book, The Witches, Salem 1692, as well as the hashtag MeToo movement. The play is a revisionist take on the American classic play, The Crucible by Arthur Miller, centering on a group of modern day high school students and their interpretation of the historical events the play is based on. It was commissioned by the Farm Theaters College Collaboration Project and developed with Center College, Rollins College, and Furman University, and workshopped as part of the 2019 OJAI Playwrights Conference's New Works Festival. The play had its premiere at the Studio Theater in Washington, D.C. in 2022. It transferred to Broadway in 2025, directed by Dana Taymor, and featuring Sadie Sink, as I said. The production received mostly positive reviews and was nominated for 4 Drama Desk Awards and 7 Tony Awards. Bellflower's Saint Pigtail was commissioned by the Studio Theater and was a 2023 O'Neill finalist. Reception. Jesse Green of the New York Times wrote that Bellflower smartly keeps the play from becoming a polemic by moving on several tracks at once, by combining such elements as pure high school comedy, pop music, and feminist interpretations of classic works. Reviewers for Am New York and Vulture wrote that John Proctor's The Villain was particularly relevant during the second presidency of Donald Trump, during which references to diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives were being discouraged by the U.S. government. A reviewer for Variety wrote that John Proctor's The Villain interpreted The Crucible through a feminist lens, demonstrating the power of feminine solidarity and rage, a sentiment shared by an Entertainment Weekly critic. Another reviewer for The Hollywood Reporter called the storyline a poignant story of girlhood and empowering friendships. Conversely, a writer for The Wrap described the short scenes as characteristic of novice playwrights, and a New York Daily News writer said, "I wish John Proctor made its very fair point about girls forging their own narratives with more ambivalence and less certitude." That was all about the Broadway production for London. Sarah Hemming of the Financial Times described the play as a joyous, blazingly intelligent play, at once a restless interrogation of the role of art in defining and expressing who we are, a compassionate, funny portrayal of what it means to be a teenage girl, and a furious appraisal of the way power games repeat across generations. Sarah Compton from What's On Stage wrote that the play is a witty and convincing picture of teenage girlhood, its brightness, hopes, and fears. Alice Saville of The Independent wrote that Bellflower's play, like The Crucible, shows how quickly new ideas can contaminate a small, contained environment, spreading like penicillin spores on white bread. Wow, what an interesting simile. And yeah. This town doesn't want to take its medicine. I feel like that's all the background we have, and I think it's okay to get into it. Any other thoughts before I do the synopsis?
Go right ahead.
Okay, John Proctor's The Villain is set in a high school classroom in a small rural Georgia town in 2018. Carter Smith is the English teacher for several 11th graders. The straight A student Beth, the new transfer student Nell, she's from Atlanta, the wealthy girl Ivy, the pastor's daughter Raylin, the slightly awkward Mason, and Raylin's boyfriend, I would say ex-boyfriend at this time, Lee. Mr. Smith assigns the students the play The Crucible, the protagonist of which is John Proctor, who is convicted of witchcraft during the Salem witch trials. Beth forms the school's feminist club with Mr. Smith as its sponsor. Tensions rise when Raylan's estranged friend Shelby returns to school after a prolonged absence. During the semester, Ivy's father is accused of sexual harassment during the Me Too movement, a source of controversy in the small town, causing her to withdraw from the club. Lee tries to repair his relationship with Raylan, having cheated on her with Shelby. Miss Scout, and it's also thought that maybe Shelby had a relationship with Ivy's father, so that's also in there as a rumor. Miss Gallagher, the school's guidance counselor, mediates various issues between Mr. Smith and the students. I would say Miss Gallagher, who is the school's guidance counselor, she is first time to this role, having taken over from the long-standing guidance counselor, is trying to navigate what it's like to be in this school in this particular role. And at first she's unsure about the feminist club, but decides to support them because Mr. Smith is supporting them, I would say. Over the course of the year, the class discusses The Crucible's themes of power, gender inequality, and female sexuality. In a tense class period, Shelby loudly disagrees with Mr. Smith's insistence that John Proctor is a good man, especially focusing on his name and holding on to it, and announces at the very end that Mr. Smith had been sexually abusing her over the last year. The accusation causes waves throughout the town. Despite her feminist ideals, Beth deeply admires Mr. Smith and is reluctant to believe Shelby, further straining relations among the girls. Nell and Mason grow closer, but Mason insults Shelby's perceived promiscuity, causing her to take off. Ray Lynn, her reluctant assigned partner for an interpretive project based on the play, follows her and the two reconcile. Shelby admits that Mr. Smith's abuse of power had left her feeling vulnerable, which is why she slept with Lee. Mr. Smith is allowed to continue teaching and turns his attentions to Beth. That's a weird way of phrasing it. I think his attentions had already been on Beth, because you find out very casually that he and Beth were in a texting relationship, which some students are like, I'm so sorry. Nell in particular is like, should you be texting him? ... On the day of the project presentation, Ms. Gallagher, who has been assigned by the school board to supervise Mr. Smith's class, reveals to him she has been aware of rumors of his predatory behavior since college. I will say that this is very shocking as you read this, because it is clear that she has a crush on him. And so I do want to talk about her, because I feel very conflicted about that particular character, because it's almost like it took four different accusations for her to sort of wake up about it. So just be aware of that situation. It's not like, you know, she was suspicious of him all along. I feel like that was not the intent of that character. Ray Lynn and Shelby, acting as Elizabeth Proctor and Abigail Williams from the play, imagine a world where their actions are not defined by the men in their lives. They begin dancing, echoing Abigail's dance in the woods. Mr. Smith angrily attempts to stop the performance, but the girls' cathartic dance is supported by Nell, Mason, and Ms. Gallagher. In the final moments of the dance, Beth stands from her desk and takes a step towards the girls. The lights go out, leaving the audience to wonder if Beth joins them. Okay. Tom, did you like John Proctor as the villain?
I did. There's like kind of holes in the play that maybe I need to give it another read or see a performance that it might be more clear.
Mm-hmm.
And we can come to the question. And I thought the ending was a little bit too much. I don't know. Again, maybe if you see it on stage, it works.
Yeah.
But I thought it was, and I know these are high school students, so they are definitely going to be more out there in terms of the sincerity, the literalness and everything. So it's not out of character for the way some of the characters behave in this. But I don't know. It just kind of like, yeah, I was like, not that I didn't like the ending. It's just that I've only ever read the play, so I don't know what it looks like.
Yeah. And I will say
that's better.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and because you have your interpretation of what that might look like, and, you know, directors are going to have their own, and actors and everything. And it's interesting being in a space with other people, because, you know, the audience sometimes has an interpretation that maybe individuals do not. For example, the scene where the girls are in the classroom screaming, it goes on for a while, not as long as the laughing, which, you know, in the stage direction say that it should be uncomfortable because of how long the laughing goes on. But several members, enough that you can hear, of the audience were laughing at the screaming. And I turned to, like, both of us were really uncomfortable, because it wasn't supposed to be funny. It was just like this frustration of everything that was going on. So to interpret it as a funny scene seemed a bit odd for me. So just to give an example of that. Yes, I really liked the performance. I thought that it was really moving. I know Claire was emotionally moved with that green light scene at the end. Well, one of my questions is when or if you were suspicious of Carter, but when that was dropped, like that was a sort of moment. And then, you know, you kind of, it's all downhill from there. It's a very rapid decline. I think there are definitely moments that maybe need a bit more, like even, and I know it's about the young ladies, but the guys are very much one-dimensional, and I think Mason begins to move out of that a little bit, though I hesitate because it seems like, oh, is he just doing that because of Nell, or is he actually looking to grow? But Lee just seems like he's always going to be that particular person. And I think Lee is one of the people that Bellflower says, because she gives options for who could be a student, a student of color. And I think Lee, she says, yeah, Lee and Mr. Smith are white, full stop. And I think that would be just because of how Lee acts. But I do agree with you. I think there might be some gaps there that, fill it in. The reconcile between Shelby and Raylan, I think, is rather quick. Because it's already starting, I think, before everything is revealed. And I think given how teenage girls typically are and holding a grudge longer than, other people might, I feel like this would have taken some time until that realization that, oh, there was a reason for what happened. Yeah, I'm trying to, I also have to separate my reading of it from my experience of it too. But I do, yes, I do really like it. I think there are some really powerful moments. But as with an ensemble cast, because we've of course talked about this with other novels that we've done, you have to make space, enough space for every character to have, to be able to describe them individually. And I think beyond Beth, like some people merge together, and there's not enough because it's just there's something defining about them. Beth, I think, is pretty developed, and Shelby, I guess, is pretty developed. But Raylan, is she just like a preacher's daughter who
She's
had a
kind of
falling out with her
reactive a
friend?
lot
Yeah.
too.
Nell is she's from Atlanta. Like, is that her big thing? Ivy, she's just this girl who has a father that is sexually harassing people. So what else do we have about them? I think that would be more. But if you're demanding to have an hour and a half runtime, one act, then you've got to, or I guess it could be split in a couple acts, but one, there's no intermission. So what, you don't have a lot of space to deal with that.
Good point. I just, like I said, there's a couple of things that, and I know we're going to get kind of into it, but I think the thing that, actually, we probably get into it with the questions and I'll bring it up later. So,
Okay.
which is not really criticism, just kind of questions of like where certain things go and where certain things are dropped in and never really mentioned again. So, like, kind of trying to figure out some of the bits. And I do wonder if there's maybe one or two too many characters, if it's got to be this short, close, short of a play, or like you
Yeah.
have too big of a cast, and that's why some of the main characters are a little two dimensional. But we'll get in there.
We will, yeah. Well, my first question is actually about Carter, Mr. Smith. Did you become suspicious of him? And if so, when did you become suspicious?
I was not suspicious of him. Because I wasn't really paying attention to him,
Okay.
if I'm being completely honest. I was
Sure.
paying attention to the girls in terms of their dialogue back and forth. And Carter, to me, seemed like the anchor for all of kind of the wayward dialogue to kind of bring them back into where they needed to be. And that was kind of his role. Now, when I kind of thought back on it and looked at a couple of lines, and seems to like, oh, here were some of the hints that were dropped, and some of them were pretty subtle. Because he comes off as like the cool feminist teacher who they can trust and really does have a bond with some of these students and things like that. And that's not always a red flag with teachers, but you can start to see where these lines are crossed. And I think one of the some of the interactions with Ms. Gallagher are like you kind of see it creeping in. But no, I did not clock that the first time I was reading it. What about you?
Yeah, yeah, I can only say as I was watching it, yeah, he seemed great. I thought, oh, look at how great a teacher he is. And then as they started to talk about, well, the Me Too came up a couple of times, I thought, oh, are we going to do something with this? And then as they were talking about John Proctor and Goody Proctor having a child, and then also Smith and his wife having a child, I was like, oh, are we Are we making a connection between the two
Oh, yeah,
here?
good point.
Is something starting to happen here? So then I became a bit suspicious, especially with one of the conversations that he had with Beth. It seemed a little too intimate. Just like it seemed like they were having a conversation outside of school that I was trying to suss out, because she was talking about like The Great Gatsby and he was saying, "Oh yeah, I loved what you had to say." And I thought, when's she talking to him? So then when the big shebang was, and just the way that Shelby says it, you know, that he says leave, I think it was, and she said, "Well, that's not what you said before when you're telling me to come," or something like that. And you're like, "Oh my gosh." And then the lights go down, it's wild. Yeah, so that would have been I think once I started to, but you know, it still is very impactful once it happens. I will say, once that happened, I turned to Claire and I said, "You know what? The only re unrealistic thing I think is how quick that process happened, and I don't think that she would have, Shelby would have been allowed in his presence at all." Because I just think about some of the people that have been put on leave at York County that you know isn't as a sub that I've seen, and they're gone for months, and there's like this whole investigative process, and then yeah, so that was a bit unbelievable for me.
That was one of the things where I go back and forth on, where I'm like, because it is freaking deep red rural Georgia, which can be very good old boys club. Let's sweep this under the rug, especially when it comes to boys and men being predators in some way or another toward women. And that's why I think that the note in, or her note, or her, what she said about the characters, and that he has to be white, I think that's why it makes a lot of sense. Because if the character was black, they would have kicked his ass out of that school the moment anybody made A, because of the way that system is built in rural schools like that, having taught in one. And I know it's not overtly racist all the time, but I could totally see an African American male, like, not getting that second chance in a district like this, but somebody who's like Mr. Smith, who's well liked and everything, them sweeping it under the rug, and more or less her having to transfer or take a year off or whatever she ended up doing, I'm trying to remember, and then coming back. It actually is slightly realistic based on what I remember from cases where maybe it wasn't a teacher, but it was like a student, like a football player, had been accused of raping a student, and she was the one who got kind of run out of town on it and things like that. But at the same time, yeah, I'm like, unless it was so swept under the rug that like nobody could really substantiate what had been said, I can't imagine that they would A, let him back in. He would have been suspended without pay or transferred to another school somewhere. But it is convenient for, there's a little too convenient for the plot. But and her revelation of it, Shelby comes off, and if Sadie's thing's playing her, she comes off as a little bit more tough or rougher than the other girls, at least from what I could see when I'm reading it. So an outburst like that would make total sense. But it was weird to me that she wasn't as uncomfortable as I would have predicted that she would be around him when she first comes back, because she
Oh my
comes
gosh,
back and
yeah.
sees Miss Gallagher, and like he's sitting in the office with her, and he's like, she's like, I'm fine. Now she's probably putting up some sort of defense or anything. And I know that we don't want to telegraph what's actually going on because that's one of the big reveals. But at the same time, it was a little weird to me that like if she's faking it so that she can kind of like, you know, protect herself, I don't know if that comes up. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely unclear. Even knowing what I knew and reading it, like everything seems okay. And she's asking, unless you have to read between the lines, you know, she asks about the baby and I think his wife. And so you're like, oh, okay, is there something going on? But yeah, it's kind of wild. And even how he speaks about her to Miss Gallagher, it's as if she is a little bit better than a stranger. Yeah, she's had some rough time. It was just like as if you're talking about a student that you really don't know well at all, which is quite interesting. But I will say her diatribe, I guess if we were to have a not better word for it, that it loses me a bit just because I'm like trying to find the connection between Well, number one, I wonder why is this the moment that she decides to out him? Mm-hmm. And number two, like, where is, like, I'm trying to follow her through line of her talking about Proctor, and I guess it's about his good name. And so it's related to Smith's reputation, yeah, all of that. But there just seems to be a jump in logic of like, but when, well, no, this is what I'm talking about. And then has it thrown out there. So that's something that I had trouble the first time when I watched it. And then second time, as I was reading it more slowly, I'm trying to follow her reasoning, but 16-year-old, you know? Yeah. So in her mind, she's having those connections. And maybe it's just reading. Well, I think this play brings up a lot for her, which is obviously why the title of the whole play outside of the play is Don Proctor's the Villain. And we find out she did all these deep dives, right, of different things. So I feel like it created when she was on her quote-unquote sabbatical, which is not the Sabbath as the joke was made, or the malapropism, I guess, was made in the play. Something I think was unsettling for her, and then she starts to do a deep dive. So perhaps this is just the moment that she feels like she needs to go for it. And maybe she needs that audience. When did Abby have an audience when she starts accusing people?
There's at least, Abigail, you mean, there's at least now the accusations have been kind of leveled, or they're kind of in the background. There's at least one scene where she's in a courtroom with the other girls who are accusing people of being witches, accusing these people of being witches, and we know as an audience that they're faking the whole time, but they're in front of like the judges of the town, and I think Proctor's there or whatever. And keep in mind, I haven't read The Crucible in a very long time, probably about 18 years at this point, but I do recall, because I remember the Winona Ryder movie, that they pretend that they're seeing some sort of weird vision and they're freaking out, and so they deliberately cause ruckus and stuff like that. So, yeah. So there are a couple of public accusations and confrontations and things. And then the scene where he's screaming about his name, it's like right before he's going to be, he's scheduled to be executed stuff. So, yeah. But yeah, so there is some sort of public spectacle that Abigail and the girls in Salem are raising.
Yeah. So I wonder if she feels like she's the Abigail, and so she's got to do it in front of an audience, and this is the best way to do it. Yeah. But yeah, I do wonder why then. I mean, I'm glad she spoke up, but I just wonder the moment. Why did it happen in that way? But anyways, we'll move on. How does the play expose these subtle ways adults wield power over teens, especially in educational settings?
I'll get to that one second. I was just kind of flipping through the scene where Shelby comes in for the first time in Miss Gallagher's office. Gallagher doesn't know why Shelby left. It was rumor and everything. So the fact that he's pushing this, she had a breakdown thing or whatever, is him trying to, and the concern, it's him trying to get Gallagher on his side so that people won't believe Shelby if it ever comes up, I think. He's gaslighting her, basically, in a sense. All right. How does the play expose? Oh, man. The one thing I picked up on pretty early is that he's grooming Beth. Ooh. The entire, like, I clocked that almost right away. That's one of the better things in the play in terms of the way it's written, because it's subtle. And then as things, accusations come out, and you start paying a little more attention to how he's treating Beth, and maybe the other girls, but especially Beth, you're like, oh, wait. She's the next one. And I remember teachers in my high school who had very odd relationships with some of the girls they taught. And being, you know, a teenager who's very sheltered and really didn't clock any of that stuff, or saw it but didn't really say anything, you know, it was just kind of like, okay, this is strange, but, you know, you kind of let it go. Or you notice how a teacher, or a couple of male English teachers I had, in junior high, at least one of them, I remember here and there, he seemed to pay a little more attention to this one girl who was in my class. But I don't know if, you know, I don't know if anything ever was going on there, or what, if he was accused of anything. But it's like, you know, when you look back, especially in the wake of years and years of this being shown in the news and the era in which this is taking place, you start to kind of, do the math backwards, and start putting those pieces together and like, oh wow. And I heard that one of my history teachers who had this very weirdly close relationship with a student where she'd like kind of go up to him and hug all on him. It was bizarre. Even we thought it was bizarre. We'd heard that he had been fired years later for something very similar to this, for like a sexual harassment issue or something. And we were like, yeah, that kind of tracks. So, but it is the sort of like, Shelby kind of had to kind of go away, and there was no true accusation filed, it seemed. And if that's the case, then I get how he's still teaching there, because it doesn't sound like she actually ever, for lack of a better word, pressed charges. Is she just kind of, it was a prolonged absence, and Gallagher just has like, and maybe they aren't telling Gallagher everything because they want to make sure that, he is able to, be a teacher. They don't want to make noise. They don't want it to get out and everything. And yeah, but the grooming, and then the again, like, he can gain the access he wants by being the feminist club sponsor, right? That sort of fake skeezy guy who insists that he's the performative feminist, and then you find out like, wow, he was kind of using that to lure girls or women. Like, he's the safe guy, the nice guy. We've seen this with certain writers and movie directors in the wake of Me Too, who were very like, they wrote stuff that was very progressive or very considered feminist, and they turned out to be real scum. So I thought that that was what they did well with Smith's character. But yeah, it's a very realistic play in that regard. I've never harassed a student, by the way. I would like to say that. I don't touch students at all.
Yeah,
I've
no,
had
that's the
great
best.
relationships with boys and girls in my classes, but I've always known where the line is. I don't even think I even step up to that line. Plus, I'm old enough to be these girls' father, literally. I mean, it's gross to begin with.
Yeah, I think it's always safe to never touch your students. Some students go in for hugs. They become sad when you like deny them hugs. And I tell them, at the end of the year, if you want a hug, I will give you one. But yeah, I don't typically hug randomly anyways. But with students, absolutely not.
I will hug you at graduation.
Yeah, there you go. I'd be like, look, I'm proud of you, young person.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, it's interesting, right? Because this is why it's scary, because we are in this position of authority. We are supposed to be the safe place, we as in teachers, educators, and then this kind of stuff happens. And this is not just some fanciful tale, but I'm sure we could have said, well, I think actually, in fact, two, a sister and a mother of an actor were recently put on administrative leave because of things like this. So that was recent, so these things unfortunately do happen. And I think because maybe, I wonder if parasocial is the right
It
term,
might be,
but
yeah.
you know how sometimes people have maybe interesting ideas about themselves and their therapist potentially. I feel it in a similar way, like maybe you're projecting some sort of feelings on them. And so you feel like, oh my gosh, if this person's showing interest in me, like I think that's really special, and not seeing the wrongness of it. And with Carter and Beth, Mr. Smith and Beth, I feel like it was a lot of intellectual conversation, but also I think that it would go into a little too much, as in like we're looking like friends right here. So I think it starts off in one way, and that's how they get you, because then you feel like, oh, this is so cool, I can have these chats with my teacher, and then it just gets a bit out of control. I'm hoping that Beth has not been touched ever. I didn't get that sense necessarily, but I could very much be wrong, just because of how nervous she got when talking about naked, was it naked Harry Styles or somebody? I can't remember, some pop stars. Yeah. So it's definitely not. I think that Bellflower does a good job of being really subtle in what this looks like. And then you kind of extrapolate out and you think, well, if this is what it was like for Beth, I wonder what it looked like for Shelby, who's a completely different character on page. And so I feel like his approach would have been different. But as she says in her monologue, I think it was all about reaching out to this person who might have been told a lot of times that she's not good enough or she's a bit too much, and saying like, you are smart, you all that. So giving that confidence to someone, which is what, we're told people who are sex traffickers do, because they look for the people who are not confident and then they start to kind of beef them up and then they're taken. So they look for the vulnerable and prey upon them. So yeah, because I feel like Nell would not be a target for Carter, unsure about Ivy at the time. But yeah, it's quite unfortunate. And then you wonder, as you said, how many were there beyond these people? Because we know of when Carter was younger, when he was in college, but then you wonder, oh gosh, how long as a teacher has he been up to this stuff?
I don't think anything's happened with Beth because I get the feeling that if it had, she would have been more sympathetic to Shelby. We wouldn't have had that decision that she is in the middle of making when the curtain falls, right?
Right.
So she is still, he's playing a different angle. She's a straight A student. He's kind of going after her vulnerability, maybe. Socially, maybe picking on some imposter syndrome that's going on. Like he's working a different angle with her than he had been with Shelby. And he's clearly at the stage of grooming where I don't think it's fully made his move yet. I don't think like a groomer, so I don't know. But I just got the feeling that he's not there yet with her, that it's he's starting to get to the point. If they're texting or talking after school is out, I don't think anything has happened, and that's why Beth can defend him as well as she can, because she's like, I don't see him doing anything like this, and all he's doing right now is just he and I have a really good relationship as teacher student. There's nothing really abnormal about that, right? So, as a teacher, by the way, you should never have your student socials. So,
No, that's a good idea. A mistake I made when I was quite young, I mean, right out of college, right? Because it was hard to find that line of like you're 22 and you have, these people who are basically your age. Yeah. So, but I also recommend that. Or if you have to like contact them, have an admin on the group chat or something like that. So where do you see characters internalizing or reproducing victim blaming narratives?
There's the obvious scene where Mason slut shames Shelby, and it's kind of like, which is a very typical, if it's not what was she wearing, well, she's the promiscuous type, no wonder she got assaulted. You know, that sort of line of reasoning, and that's kind of where he's going with that.
Yeah.
Shelby doesn't take it, and I really, really like that. In fact, Shelby calls him out on it. She says, I feel a lot better now to know that even one shitty human being who smells like cheese is on my side. And Beth defends him. And Nell says, yeah, and he smells really good. And then basically calls Beth a hypocrite, and she storms out. Shelby storms out, and then, and Mason's like, well, I thought I was backing Beth up. So Beth was kind of doing it, but a little more subtly. The not believing the victim goes right into Shelby's having, well, which is, I mentioned that a little earlier, Shelby's having left. And whatever, if there's anything formal against Mr. Carter, it's rumor or it was swept under the rug because Gallagher doesn't even know. And Gallagher seems kind of conflicted, as you mentioned. We'll probably get to her, but yeah, so it's there, but it's in like sort of like everyday speech in a big way. And I think that's effective too, because there's not enormous debates on it, except for the times where somebody says something like that. And for Mason to say something like that actually does drive very well with like what a dumbass teenage boy would say.
Yeah, and it is interesting when Shelby asks to talk to Beth, if I wonder if Shelby knows that Beth and Carter converse via text.
I think she picks up on it. Yeah,
and she's kind of looking for someone to back her up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Gallagher, which I have a question about this, obviously, with the counselor about, is she a protector, an enabler, or a bystander? Very complicated. Well, I would say a complicated, I don't have to say very complicated character, but to what extent, like, does it really need four people to convince you that this might not be a good guy? And what's going on there? Why do you need that much evidence in order to do that? I mean, one, like, if you're really hesitant and one is not going to cut it, like, two, I mean, right there, you know what I'm saying? So the fact that she was just holding on is wild, and having all of these reports, and then now we've gotten down to a child, which is even worse. Yeah. Well, yeah. With Ivy, did you talk about Ivy and her father? Because she's all about, he's such a great guy.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It was probably consensual, all of that stuff. You know, why would she go to another job and he would help her if all of that stuff? I'm like, oh my gosh. So when you're so close to someone, you feel like, I know this person, and are unwilling to hear somebody else out. Yeah, and blaming the other party.
That happened a lot during the Me Too era with people who were working for some of the higher profile people who were being accused and then proving of doing some very vile things. Matt Lauer comes up in my mind, and because people who he worked with on camera, like I think Katie Kirk or something, were like originally released, like I think, and don't hold me to this, but I think I remember them releasing statements or saying that, like, you know, I never saw anything like this and he's always been a great guy. But isn't that what they do, right? Like the high profile people, the people who are going to notice the most, they protect it. And because they're preying on vulnerable people, you know, they're going to make themselves look good to everybody else, so that when the accusation comes out, they're like, oh no, he could never do that. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. he's such a good guy. Like in the same way, like when he's sitting in Gallagher's office and he's like, you know, most people would just kind of try to sign some paperwork and shove this under the rug about like accusations and stuff. And he's like, you know, you're honest about it. He's flattering her to kind of, again, get him over to her side. And it bugs me that it does take four people, especially considering she's a mandatory reporter, but also consider that she is being flattered by him. She kind of has a crush on him.
Mm-hmm.
That's big enough, I guess, in her character to be able to ignore or sweep away what they're saying he does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because I sometimes forget that he's married, because I don't think you find out until later on. And so the way he's acting, you're like, oh, should I ship him and the counselor? And I'm like, sure, why not? And then you're like, oh, wait, he's married. Why is he acting this way?
Jeez.
Yeah, a little bit. How do the girls navigate the conflicting expectations placed on them by their community?
This one's tough. I'm going to punt this back to you.
Okay. Well, I guess it depends on which character we're looking at. If I were to look at Ray Lynn in particular, I think the expectation for her is that she be a virgin, celibate, giving of her, you know, body to Christ, and acting in that way, you know, because she is the preacher's daughter. And she is wrestling with, I think, her sexuality, and then also, how does she want to show that? Does she go back to the one person that like she has this person available for her, but is that the best person to go? I would say so. That's something there that I think there's something placed on her by the church community, and she's kind of wrestling with that and trying to strike out. But what's a healthy output for that, and what is not?
It is a little bit of a subtle dig at, especially when you're in Southern Georgia, that kind of brand of Christianity in that church where there has been a lot of protection of sex events.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the Catholics aren't exactly not guilty, right? But I'm innocent of it. But like, you know, the idea that there's a patriarchal hold over girls in a church like Ray is attending, where like, I'm picturing like purity culture being rampant, There are some, not maybe this isn't where she's at. I mean, there have been some stories of very evangelical churches or people grooming, doing the same thing that Smith's doing, and then eventually marrying the girls. And like you start to do the math and like, wait a second, you were 17 when you met him and you got married at 19, but he'd known you for 5 years. Like, I've read some really horrific stories.
Well, there's a recent one, isn't there, with a congressman?
So it that it's a little she doesn't go too deep into it in the play because it's not as it would be too much of a tangent, but I think she drops a couple things there that are good commentary.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think
Sorry to
you
interrupt you.
No, that's good. No, I was just trying to think of another character to
You
potentially do that. I
did
think,
mention Ivy.
yeah, Ivy, maybe Miss Gallagher, who I feel like has these she expectations she's either forcing on herself or she feels like people are forcing on her because she grew up in this town. People know her, she knows the people. And then what does this role look like? She's also stepping in to a role that had been filled by someone for a long time. So that's a lot there. And she wants to make her way. So, potentially the lady before. Yeah, because if this is her first year, then that means would the lady before have seen stuff with Carter Smith and not have reported it?
Or she did try to bring it up and she got it didn't say what the lady before hap what happened to her. Like it didn't say she was fired, right?
Yeah,
Or anything like that.
no,
So she
I think
might
it
have
was a
either
retirement, but yeah.
okay, it was a retirement or something, but maybe she didn't. It got swept under the rug, or maybe she swept it under the rug if she was retiring and didn't want to deal with it
Yeah.
in retirement. Or the other possibility would be she did say something and they transferred her somewhere else.
Yeah. So it's very interesting.
There's
Yeah.
a
And
there,
yeah.
there's too many ways the system will work against these girls,
Yeah,
and that's what's
absolutely.
scary about this.
Yeah. So I think it really comes down to what people, this is the expectation of, but this is how I want to be. And how can that be? With Beth, I feel like she just fits into whatever the expectation is. But it's maybe at the last moment, which of course is my last question. Once we get there, maybe she's finally striking out on her own. How does the play challenge the heroic framing of John Proctor from The Crucible? And what does this play suggest about who gets to be a hero in classic literature?
Yeah, it's interesting because Miller is setting the Crucible amongst a real life historical event, the Salem witch trials, and there were accusations, of these sorts made. I don't know how much he was thinking of the way that Proctor is this sort of male hero. Other than he is being accused so he can use this allegory that he's going for in the Crucible for McCarthy and the House on Activities Committee and the Red Scare of the 50s, because the Crucible essentially is an allegory for McCarthyism as it was going on, because Miller himself was accused of being a communist. But yeah, Proctor's supposed to be the upstanding man whose reputation is tarnished, and he is supposed to handle everything with integrity, even though he has had this affair, and he is a little bit more of a he's a little more complex than just kind of the hero. But it is a little weird when I think about it to like really not have a deeper conversation about how the interaction between him and Abigail and kind of balancing that against one another. So when they're kind of twisting this around, I don't think they're doing like a lazy TikTok-y so and so is problematic because XYZ, because if you say that you get clicks. I think they're really trying to look at and as the playwright, she's trying to look at the character and be like, he is the protagonist. He is in some way still the hero because he's the wrongfully accused. But let's not think he is innocent in everything. And the play centers him and does set the voices of the female characters aside. So I think that's a legitimate criticism of the play, and I think it's done very well in here, because sometimes you see people reinterpreting a play or looking at something or a novel or whatever, and I get what they're saying, but they're going about it way too broadly. And I think that Bellflower as a writer is hitting the points where they need to be hit, so that her argument is pretty strong.
Yeah, it's like Antigone, because I saw a modern retelling of that, and you're like, oh wow, that's true. That, and it's called Antigone, but it's really about all this other stuff. It's not about, Antigone. It's about, it's all these men in her life, so they are very much pushed. Yeah, I like to question. I think people need to understand that a protagonist isn't always necessarily a hero. I feel like this is true with foreshadowing the Odyssey as well. That there are definitely, which I think makes amazing characters, that if they are complex, what are their issues and things like that. So I like that we get to investigate a bit more who John Proctor is, and we don't just go along with whatever SparkNotes has to say, but look at this other interpretation, especially in the context of the time, because I think we've had other discussions as to when we reread literature that is especially important to us, that our place in time often affect, or like our emotional place in time often affects our reading of it. And so I think reading The Crucible when it was happening is one thing. During Me Too, is quite an, so setting it now has this new flavor, I think, come through. And yeah, we throw about hero, but what does that, actually, would you call Jay Gatsby a hero, that sort of thing. So I think defining what that might be, and does it have to follow a hero's journey, that sort of thing.
The idea that there's I follow some book talk and Bookstagram accounts, and I've seen a number of posts over the last maybe couple of months where people are pointing out the whole idea of the protagonist does not have to be a hero. Some one person who was bringing this point up used Nabokov's Lolita and Humbert. I've never read the book. Humbert, I think, is the name of the main character, and how he's the protagonist, but there's no way this guy's a hero, but that's the whole point. Victor Frankenstein is always my go-to of, because it's, again, and you're right, it's like when the characters are complicated, and my teacher, 10th grade teacher, said the source of all great literature is moral ambiguity. So that idea that there's a that they're very complicated, they're more human that way. I think we've been too used to expecting heroism in a lot of our texts, in a way that, like, we ignore even the more subtle complications of the character because we need a hero to win the day. But that ultimately can be very boring.
Well, on the flip side, is Carter a villain, a product of his environment, or something more complicated?
I think he's enabled by his environment.
Oh.
I think he's a villain, not in the Lex Luthor laughing at Superman while he steals 40 cakes sort of way, or the mustache twirling type, but he's a sleaze. And when you look at how he talks to the women, in that sort of, like I said, he's the sort of, like, I'm going to show you how much of a feminist I am, but it's because I'm just trying to weasel my way in. And when I do take what I want, it's really gross, disgusting. And I think that makes him a villain.
Do you think that he and, was his name Jason Bateman of American Psycho?
Patrick Bateman.
Patrick Bateman. Do you think that there is a person?
Jason
I
Bateman is an
apologize.
actor.
Yeah. I knew it was Bateman, but okay.
Patrick Bateman,
Do
yeah.
you think that they are of a similar ilk?
Patrick Bateman's way more cartoonish. And like, it's, I mean, he's the, I've never read the novel. I've only seen the movie, and it's like, it's part satire. It's very, very over the top on purpose. And plus, Bateman, I think his occupation is like Wall Street or something, or law or something, where you don't need to be nice to other people. You can be a competitive douche. There's a smarminess to Carter because the fact that he has to be nice, and he's entrusted with something that's different than like a stock portfolio and stuff like that. So.
Yeah, I guess I just see the, and I've not seen, I think I saw a couple scenes and then was quite disturbed when he opens a refrigerator and there's like a head in there.
It's been a
But
very, very long time since I watched the movies.
yeah, and I think if I know correctly from like a Wikipedia thing that it was all like a dream or something, like it's all a fanciful, imaginary situation. He's not real. But I think he's dating Reese Witherspoon. And so you have this like really clean cut person, you know, on one side, but then on the other side it seems he's a psychopath. So that's why I wondered if they were, if he felt like they were similar. Is he, yeah, product of his environment, I guess in the enabling sort of sense, like, hey, you're, you know, this great looking, charismatic guy, you are entitled to whatever you want. And so he takes that as it is. I would only lean towards complicated if given, I mean, they were doing sex ed at the very beginning of the play and reading off definitions, et cetera. I don't know when that started, but I would only say he's complicated if there had been no education about, you know, these sorts of things. But at the same time, you know, a predator is a predator. So that's not necessarily, I feel like that's something that is kind of there, unfortunately. So yeah, I feel as a cop out, I would say like I think there's a little bit of pile A, B, and C. Because I think in order to prevent predators, I think it does require some education, and unfortunately, some are just not going to listen at all, and that's just kind of their way of being. So, yeah. Okay, Beth, how do you see her understanding of herself shift over the course of the play? Or does it? Because I'm leading, that's a leading question. Does it shift over the course of the play?
Do you think she realizes how much more naive she is than she thinks? Like she's like a very trusting person, it seems. And she's also open to like learning things. She is taking the initiative on the one of the people taking the initiative on the feminist club. So she's one of the better characters of the play. But the whole thing with Mr. Smith and everything and the grooming, I don't think she realizes what's happening until. I mean, in my mind, she's probably starting to put two and two together as the end of the play approaches, and I think that's her growth. Like, and I don't know how she'll react to that. Will it anger her and she'll stand up, or will she be so ashamed of it that she curls up and crawls into a hole or something?
Yeah. And I wonder if a lot of it is coming through her own trying to educate others as well as her own self-education through this feminist club. Because I think sometimes we see a lot of things in front of us and it's like we're not actually seeing it. You know, like it's actually speaking to us. We are doing these things, but we're not admitting that to ourselves. And so I think she's got all of this in front of her about stuff. She's trying to educate about the Me Too movement and all of that. And there's something, you know, unsettling that is there that she's participating in. And I think Shelby is like the maybe the catalyst of the wake up call, but even that not wanting to talk with her is still that denial. But then seeing that dance and seeing that connection between Abigail, well, the fictional connection between Abigail and Goody and that dance, I think might be finally the wake up call. My hope is, you know, if there were another act, whether Beth dances or not, is that Miss Gallagher maybe speaks to Beth because hopefully she has noticed, you know, that he is around her. So definitely doing her due diligence there. But hers is very much as I feel like you don't see it until the very end, her growth. Because I think there's just like a lot of denial. And again, yeah, just really enjoying this focus and attention on herself, which is understandable.
Yeah, normally I'd be like all of a sudden she's realizing things, but it actually works really well because it's very realistic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially if you're in denial for a long time.
Yeah. How does Ivy function as both a catalyst and a mirror for the other girls?
Okay, so Ivy's dad, they mentioned the mayor at one point too, but Ivy's dad is accused of doing exactly what Mr. Smith is doing, right? Like harassing and having inappropriate relationships with, I think, teenagers or people he works with.
People he
The
worked at, yeah.
yeah. So she's conflicted. She's a mirror for, I guess, maybe Shelby or some Beth, some of the things are going on because up at once we don't know what Mr. Smith is doing when we find out about Ivy's father. The thing that bugged me is that it comes up and then at one point it's just never mentioned again. Like, not that we had to see Ivy's father on trial, but like, if you're bringing it up so that you can kind of see this along to where Smith's doing the same thing, I get it. But at the same time, that's a really heavy thing. And he's being accused of it. And Ivy kind of fades, and so does the whole thing with the father. So it's almost like a plot hole. Not completely, but it's almost like a plot hole because it never comes up again at one point. I know we have to kind of dive into the Smith thing and the Crucible Project and all that, but don't put it there with a main character or a main secondary character. If it's just gonna be like, my dad is accused of this, I'm kind of conflicted by it, but by the end, like, where did it go? So that was my biggest problem with the play, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah, just that it gets pushed off because there's no
Yeah.
space. Yeah, what would be ideally, what would you have done?
I would have had at least some lines somewhere as we get further of, first of all, just an update of like, this is what's happening to my dad type of thing. It doesn't have to get into serious detail, but like, are things progressing and where they are? Because at that point, it's just accusation. Maybe a little bit of more stage time for Ivy. And in the midst of all this, having a conversation or something, because clearly she's upset. And there's a scene where she's alone with Beth, where they scare each other at the beginning of like getting into the classroom and everything. And I feel like there's needs to be like a couple more lines of dialogue, maybe a conversation or so later, or him mentioned later as we're working toward the final scenes of the play. Because it doesn't need to be the centerpiece of it, but if it's going to be a mirror as to what's been happening there, and Ivy is in both worlds, so to speak, because it's her father here, but her friends being harassed by a teacher, what happened to her? You know, like, where'd she go?
I feel like I don't know that Ivy and Shelby ever had a one-on-one conversation.
That's what I was wondering. I'm like,
Yeah.
where is that
I know.
conversation?
And that could have been pretty powerful because I feel like Ivy would have lashed out inevitably, and yeah, potentially called Shelby a whore or something like that because of these feelings that's going around, and then Shelby having to explain all of that, and then Ivy having maybe a realization of the damage that her father has done, I think could have been a really difficult as well as great moment. To add Nell again, who is Nell? She's from Atlanta. We find out that she went to horse therapy. So then you're like, oh, we're gonna find out why she had therapy question mark, you know, what you never do, never do. We have no idea. I mean, we get a throwaway line of like she's been told that she's been too much. So I don't know if it's sort of the angst that comes with being a young woman and how people act towards you and things like that, or if there was something deeper. But you know that could have been something for sure.
First of all, Ivy would have been a great character to do the you're ruining a man's life line because of what's happening to her father, even though she might not completely believe it and is blind to it. With Nell, you're right. And I get they all kind of have problems and everything, but I think with Nell being too much, we see people talk to women all the time in that manner. Your attitude in the meeting, your attitude at work, you're abrasive sometimes because you speak out. You know, oh, you're a little too much, meaning that you're not easily coyed, you know, and put away. Boys can be loud. Girls need to be quiet, which is total crap. But that's what's kind of in what she's saying. Well, you can be a bit too much, dear. Like, you know, that sort of way of saying it, like, know your place. And I think that's a good line. But again, it probably needed to be explored a little more.
Yep, so. Absolutely. I think that moment where they're reading the play and Ivy breaks down is pretty, because I think, again, that play is getting to people in different ways.
Yeah. They're doing the thing that so many television shows that have high school as like a backdrop do, where the teacher's teaching something that episode, and all of a sudden the lesson is like so related to the plot.
Yeah.
Like the episode of Degrassi High where Eric is pregnant and all of a sudden they're having an abortion debate in the classroom, and then the end of the episode, it's a two-parter, like, you know, is she gonna go get an abortion? Like, you know, stuff like that. So,
oh boy.
I think it's done pretty well here though, because yeah. it provides a lot of the context and stuff, but I've watched a lot of television episodes like that.
A lot of Degrassi,
a lot of Degrassi.
Saved by the Bell.
Oh God.
I don't even know. How does the play portray the messy process of recognizing injustice for the first time?
I think it actually does it very well, right? Because Gallagher should be recognizing what's going on, and she's not, because for, I think, like we said, there's like three or four different reasons why. And Ivy can't let go of the feelings she has for her father. Shelby is weirdly cordial to Smith. She yells at him and lashes out. She knows what was wrong, but it's almost like at some point she is trying to keep peace. There's a lot of, like, you see the girls struggle with how they're expected to behave. Like, you know, that therefore, again, they shouldn't be speaking up when they see something like this, because it's just, it's for the adults to handle or whatever. But I think their reactions to things show that it's very hard for them to, if even if they recognize it, to act on it.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, because you're in this small town and you mm-hmm. think that it's, this can't possibly happen to us. And you feel like maybe this particular town in the, I think that's technically the Bible Belt in Georgia.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's got this moral ethical center, and you know, everything is hunky dory, and you got a one stop light because you don't need anything else, because people are obeying the laws and that sort of thing. So when this sort of thing happens, I think you are like, what is this? What are we feeling? What do we do? All of that stuff, which is, you know, could go back to, of course, Miss Gallagher, that in hearing this, not only like, oh, how could this possibly be true, but what do I do with this information? Mm-hmm. And being unwilling, which she's a licensed practitioner, so I have some questions still. As you said, a mandatory reporter. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's hard when you have never experienced that before, and just like your inner self is shaken to the core, you know, and you're like trying to figure out where to go from there. So yeah, I agree that I think it portrays it very well, because everyone's, Ivy is really messed up. Like, that's my dad. I love him. He's my dad. You know, he couldn't do this. Beth thinking, oh, but it's Mr. Smith's amazing. So everyone is just like shaken. I feel like Nell maybe isn't as, because she, you know, clocks right away, like, why are you texting with Mr. Yeah. Smith?
Nell's the outsider, though.
Yeah, that is true. Coming from the big city. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And then Raylan wrestling with her personal injustice of her best friend sleeping with her boyfriend at the time. Yeah. And then, oh, well, now, sure, it was maybe an injustice, but there was some sort of deeper psychological meaning behind it. Mm-hmm. So then I'll ask the last question of our discussion anyways, which is, did Beth dance?
This could go either way.
I know.
And I want to say that if she does, she looks right at the teacher while she's doing it. Because I think for her to do it, it would have to be like flat out defiance in some way, right? And I want to believe that she does. I want to believe that she's been slowly waking up to what's been going on and that she does. But on the other hand, I don't think she, if she doesn't do it, she never sits back down. Like she just stands there and she's really hesitant, but she kind of bystanders things and is just kind of like, I'm not going to walk in. I don't know if I, she's too scared to do it. But I don't think she wouldn't do it because she doesn't agree with them. What do you think?
Yeah, I think just her immediate, standing up, I think is a big move for Beth. And I think finally understanding maybe everything coming together for her. I'd like to think that she does maybe a few awkward gestures and then, I don't know, yeah, runs out of the room or something strange like that. But I'd like to think that she may have danced with them. Especially because Shelby already asked for her help once, and so this would be her, I think, we're giving that gesture, better late than ever.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, well then the final question is it required reading?
You know, I'm going to say yes because I look at this and I look at the teenage characters. And by and large, they're played or portrayed very realistically. I think there are a few cringeworthy lines in terms of slang, and some of the pop culture references might date the play a little bit. But I think you can blow up, brush over that if you're reading it. And I'm like, I think students would really find this engaging if I were to teach this. I think it'd be a really cool play to put on for a high school. It'd be a little controversial, especially considering there's so much of the MF word. But the language is a little bit much for like a high school production. But like, I would totally see this being put on by a local like teenage group of actors and things like that. So I think it really is worth. I think it's worth trying to make its way into a classroom, but I also think just this person who is interested in the issue and how it affects young people, I think it is worth reading. I'm really interested in seeing how it is staged. It makes me kind of want to see the play. I don't know if I'll get the chance unless there's a touring version that comes to like Richmond or something, but yeah, or if there is a if I can find footage or if there's a movie that or something that's released. But yeah, it does make me want to like I really like to see a production of this because it seems it read really well, but this seems like it'd be so much better on the stage.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I don't know if they've ever filmed this because they've been in kind of been putting stage plays in the theater.
Yeah, like
So I wonder.
Hamilton and
Yeah, they recently did Merrily We Go Around. What? I think. Yeah, Merrily We Go Along, which is on Netflix, and I think Hadestown. Yeah, so I don't know if this would warrant that. The one thing I worry about with the film, because I think that'll be great to bring in a wider audience who, people who are not able to go to New York City to see a show, is that they're gonna stuff it with unnecessary things. I think there are things, as we've discussed, that they could certainly edit, but because they have the capacity, and have interstitial moments, and like, what are we gonna do? Are we gonna be seeing them outside of school? Let's just keep it in. So that I do worry about that, but I agree. I think that it's required reading. I think this would be an amazing play to do with students. If you had a theme, maybe for a semester elective class or something like that, would bring this in, and maybe something else. It would be interesting to pair it with The Crucible, to see if that would really fly well. If it's outlandish, what they say in this particular play. But yeah, it'd be interesting to have that in two different time periods. Consider, and have history tie in. Like this would be a great cross or interdisciplinary play because you could do communism and HUAC, and then also the Me Too movement.
Yeah,
So.
feminism, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Tom, we have no feedback, which is
Nope,
very
not a
sad.
problem.
But Tom, that means that you can delight us with your pick for next time.
Yeah, so next time we've got a big one, part of a two-part crossover. because we are going to read the Odyssey, the Emily Wilson translation of the Odyssey, to be specific, just like we did with the Iliad. And since there's a movie debuting right after this episode, but right after the Odyssey episode will drop in July, over at Pop Culture Affidavit, my other show, Stella and I are going to have a conversation about the Christopher Nolan movie, The Odyssey, starring Matt Damon and Zendaya and Anne Hathaway, Tom Holland, which that will probably drop after this. So go and get the Emily Wilson translation of The Odyssey, read it, come to class prepared, and we're going to take you through Homer's epic next episode. And after that is done, about a week or two later, after the Odyssey film comes out, Stella and I will sit down and talk about it. And you'll probably hear that episode in the very end of July, very beginning of August. So come back for that. Give us feedback on this or the other episodes. And as always, thank you very much for listening and take care.
I don't know. I guess if your school decides to start a feminism club, I think you should join.
And get a female advisor for crying out
That
loud.
would probably be for the best. Or if you have a male, also have a female.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good night.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.
I do my makeup in somebody else's car. We order different drinks at the same bars. I know about what you did, and I wanna scream the truth. She thinks you love the beach, you're such a damn liar. Well, those great whites, they have big teeth.
Well, they bite you, thought you said that you would always be in love. But you're not in love, no more. Did it frighten you, how we kissed when we danced on the light of floor? On the light of floor.
But I hear sounds in my mind. New sounds in my mind. But honey, I'll be seeing you ever I go. But honey, I'll be seeing you down every road.
I'm waiting for it, that green light.
Cause honey, I wake up in a different bedroom. I whisper things, the city sings them back to you. Well, those rumors, they have big teeth.
Oh, they bite you, thought you said that you would always be in love. But you're not in love, no more. Did it frighten you, how we kissed when we danced on the light up floor?